This is the wrap-up session for this season. We'll be off the month of August, and in Mirtz Hashem, we'll resume September 7th, I believe it is, the first Sunday in September. As far as the Yom Tov schedule, we'll figure that out then. So we actually finished Perek Yud Aleph. I always had bitachon that it would happen sooner or later. And now we're up to Perek Yud Beis. This is the beginning of the story of Rechavam. So Shlomo HaMelech had passed away. Rechavam is presumably poised to take over the throne. We know, of course, there is a nevuah that the kingdom will be split. And the first part of this next parak basically describes how that happened. And it begins, Vayelech Rechavam Shechem. Rechavam went to Shechem. Ki Shechem ba kol Yisrael ha-hamlechosa. Because all of Kal Yisrael came to Shechem to make him king. Now, on its surface, it would seem that the intent of Kal Yisrael was that Rechavam should be the king, and they were not. There was no rebellion, or there was no, indication of trying to split the malchus. But beneath the surface, it's a little tricky. First of all, why did they go to Shechem? They wanted to be mamlech Rechavam. Rechavam's in Yerushalayim, so come to Yerushalayim. You want to have a public celebration, coronation of the king. It would appear that the logical place to go is Yerushalayim. Secondly, why do you need to do this all together? A melech ben melech does not require, Mashiach doesn't require a coronation. You just take over the throne. So there's already something doing here. And the Mefarshim all point out that at the very least, Kal Yisrael had a demand to make of the king, which you will see shortly, that they wanted tax cuts. They wanted a reduction in the burden that Shlomo HaMelech had placed on them, less taxes. The taxes, it was not clear, there's monetary taxes, and there's actually work tax. The people had spent time working on the public jobs. So they wanted a reduction. So they went to Shechem, the Mitzuda says, because they felt that it would be more likely that Rechavam would listen to their request in Shechem than in Yerushalayim. Because in Yerushalayim, it's his home territory, it's in the middle of Yehuda, it's where he feels strongest, where he is strongest. He wouldn't be interested in listening to their request. In Shechem, that's in the middle of Shevet Yosef, which is the potential opposition, and therefore he'd be more likely to listen. The Lashon of the Mitzudas is mashma, this really a psychological factor. It isn't that they would be able to overpower the king. Either they had no such intention, they weren't able to do it. He could always go back to Yerushalayim and gather his army, which is actually what did happen. So it wasn't because they thought that they would fight with him, but they just thought psychologically, by Yischazek, a person feels stronger, he strengthens himself in more familiar and secure territory, which is an interesting insight into human nature. Here we're talking about a king. We're not talking about an average citizen. A king probably has a whole entourage with him wherever he goes, and he knows at any point in time he could rally the troops. So that it affects him psychologically because he's away from home in potentially hostile territory is an insight. It's a little bit of a chiddush in human nature, because a king also is subject to the insecurities and the frailties of human nature. With all his melucha, with all his servants, all his royalty, but if he's away from home, he feels less secure and he's more likely to grant the request. Gedolu Mizu Matzanu, a very, very famous Rashi that many are familiar with, as well, like many of these famous Rashis. I always say that we have a big problem with the most famous Chazals, the most famous Rashis. People have gone through the educational system, so they learn it in elementary school. Right? Parshas HaShavua, whatever it is, so they already know it. So they never really pay attention to it again. So they remain within elementary school understanding of the Chazal. So you have a 7-year-old understanding of this Rashi. the Chazal, but there's a lot more to it. Because Baruch Hu came to Avraham and told him to leave. So what did he say? Lech lecha, me'aretzecha, me'la'etcha, me'esavicha. Leave your land, the place of your birth, your father's house. Rashi says, why did you have to give such a long speech? Why not just say, lech lecha, and go to the land where I'm sending you? Where he's leaving? He's leaving where he is, obviously. Because Baruch Hu describes it as, aretzecha, me'la'etcha, me'esavicha. So Rashi says, litain schara kol dibra v'dibra. That there should be an additional reward for each phrase. Why is there an additional reward for each phrase? Because Baruch Hu speaks in a lengthy, wordy fashion that makes it a bigger mitzvah. And a mitzvah, let's say, that's learned out of one word in the pasuk is a smaller mitzvah. A mitzvah that has 10 words in the pasuk is a bigger mitzvah. Do we ever find such a concept? Well, we measure mitzvahs in certain ways. We always say you don't really know how to measure mitzvahs. Mitzvah kalah should be benechah kechamura. You don't know matan schar shel mitzvahs. We measure in certain ways. We measure how. Sometimes you have, you know, greater onesh, misa, malchus, asay. That's one way of measuring. Sometimes the pasuk itself gives special importance to a mitzvah. Shekula tzitzis keneged kol Torah kula. Shekula Shabbos keneged kol Torah kula. Certain mitzvahs that are declared by implications in the pasuk, you know, to be more important. But since when do we ever find that a mitzvah is a bigger mitzvah because there are more words written in the Torah? So it's not what it means. It means each phrase made it more difficult for Avram to keep the command. Hashem emphasized, this is your land that you're leaving. And we think, oh, wow, you're right, it's my land. It makes it a little bit harder to leave. It's malada decha. Another step. It's beis avicha. And therefore, by emphasizing what he's leaving, Avram gets more schar because it made it more difficult. So the Rosh Yeshiva Zatzal pointed out, well, wait a second. It's not like Avram was, you know, Mr. Popularity in his hometown. Right? They tried to kill him. They threw him into a furnace. He escaped with his life. He was called Ivri. He was on one side. Everybody else was on the other side. He was an outcast. He was a virtual outlaw. You would think, if he has the opportunity to leave the land, great, here's my opportunity to get out of this rotten, miserable place. But you didn't find too many people, you know, all these people are trying to get out of the Soviet Union. You know, somebody comes and tells them, okay, here's your opportunity to leave your land, Maladucha, Besavicha, so never mind, I'm not leaving. It was a pretty miserable place. But Afal Pikein, human nature is human nature. Guess what? It was difficult. For those people who left the Soviet Union, it was difficult. Because it is their land. And it is Malad Chavetzud. It's what you're familiar with, where you feel comfortable. And even Avraham Avinu, as great as he was not immune to human nature. And human nature, even if your current situation is not so good, it takes a lot to pick up and leave. Because sof kol sof, people would rather have the problems they're familiar with than the unknowns that are waiting for them out there in a strange land. That's a more difficult step to take. So there is a tremendous, almost hardwired aspect of human nature. You feel an attachment to the place you grew up. So there is. It is just because a person may have had maybe a great individual and maybe even had difficulties and so on, still there's an attachment. And just because you're a king doesn't mean you don't have the attachment and the feeling of security in the more familiar surroundings. And they take you away to different territory, you feel less secure, and therefore psychologically that affects him, and it increases the chances of Rehoboam listening to their request, which of course he did not do, but this was the strategy according to the Mitzvahs. The Ralbag has a different twist, although he mentions this as well, has a different twist. As we'll see in the Pesukim later, Kaisel invited Yeravam to come to this meeting. Yeravam, you'll remember, had criticized Shlomo in public and done other things which made him into a rebellious status, and he had to run for his life to Mitzrayim. Now that Shlomo died, they're inviting him back. And the Rabbah suggests that they wanted to return Yeravam to his position. What was Yeravam's position? He was the head of Beis Yosef. Right? He was the put in charge, Shlomo Melech put him in charge of all the affairs of Shevet Yosef. Shechem is in the middle of Shevet Yosef. So they invited him there where he would be safe. Yerovam would be afraid to go to Yerushalayim, because just as Shlomo wanted to kill him, it could be Rechabim would kill him too. But in the middle of Shechem, with all his Shevet around him, then Yerovam would feel more secure, and therefore would be willing to come to the meeting. And he was a popular figure in Shechem. They wanted to appoint him as the head of Shechem, of Yosef. In the end, they appointed him as king over everyone who would follow him. So that is Rabag's reason why they went to Shechem. The Radak goes one step further. So again, we have the Matsudas and others who say that they lured him to Shechem in order that he would be less secure and therefore more willing to give in. The Rabak says they wanted Yerovam to be there because they wanted Yerovam to be returned to his position. The Radak says perhaps they intended to rebel and wanted, at least if Rechavam wasn't going to cooperate. As they made a request to Rechavam to lighten the burden, if Rechavam was not going to cooperate, they had every intention of rebelling. And they wanted Yerovam to be there to be the potential king in case things don't work out with Rechavam. So according to the Radak, this may have been actually a deliberate strategy to be in position to take over the Malucha if Rechavam does not accede to their request.
Rabbi, so I have a question. Is there any reason we can find out why Hashem divided Bnei Israel in two parts? One of them under the command of Yehovah, the other one under the kingdom of Yerevan. Why? There was any reason?
Well, we had different reasons we've discussed in the past, that the Malucha, you know, because of the Chataim, they were, you know, Beis David was not able to keep the Malucha, but because of the Schus of David, they still kept part of it. So the basic reason is this was a fulfillment of the Nevuah of Achi Shiloni because of the Chataim of Shlomo HaMelech. There is another underlying theme which we will actually get to in a moment. There was always a rivalry between Yosef and Yehuda. The Yosef, of course, is the son of Rachel, and Yehuda the son of Leah. And Yosef was the Malchus of Rachel, Yehuda was the Malchus of Leah. And the Navi talks about this, that the great accomplishment of the Geula Lasalava would be to reunite Yosef and Yehuda. Ephraim lo yikanes Yehuda, Yehuda yatzeres Ephraim. So this was a built-in tension in Klal Yisrael from the very beginning, from the days of the brothers. And certainly it was Yehuda was the leader of the brothers when they sold Yosef, although maybe, you know, he saved Yehuda, Yosef from being killed, but it was his idea to sell Yosef. And this friction between Yosef and Yehuda continued through history and continues until Mashiach comes. And that really ties in, nice little segue, ties into the next point we're going to make. There's a Maamar Chazal that says that Shechem, Kadosh Baruch Hu, we were discussing the strategies and the reasons why Klal Yisrael went to Shechem. But the ultimate reason why they went to Shechem is because that's where Kadosh Baruch Hu wanted them to be. So why did Kadosh Baruch Hu choose Shechem? Why does he want this to take place in Shechem? Says Chazal, Shechem is a makom that was muchan leperanios. Shechem was a place that was set aside for negative things, for bad things happening. Dina was attacked in Shechem, and then of course we know that the brothers wiped out the city of Shechem. Yosef was sold in Shechem, or near Shechem, and now the kingdom is divided in Shechem. So there is a pattern. This is a place that's Muchan Lepranios. We know that the Torah recognizes such things. Right now, we are in a time that's Muchan Lepranios. There's such a thing as a place which is Muchan Lepranios. There's such a thing as a time which is Muchan Lepranios, in 3 weeks, Bein HaMitzarim, that is right now, and it's particularly Tisha B'Av. What does that mean? So again, it's a concept that could easily be misunderstood. We do not believe that a place causes trouble, nor does a time cause trouble. It's not some type of a cause and effect spooky relationship here. You know, a reverse segula, although we could get into the area of segulas too. But Kadosh Baruch Hu runs the world according to how the world needs to be run. Les din below dinah. You cannot have a system of justice without judgment. But it's more, the concept is that there is something about this time or something about this place that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees fit to bring pranios, this is where it's attracted to. It's makom balchov, matzah balchov, makom ligvos eschava. You have a statement in Chazal often that HaKadosh Baruch Hu found a place to collect his debt. If Kal Yisrael is doing well, there are plenty of Tisha B'Avs that pass and there's no pranios. But if for whatever reason the Kadosh Baruch Hu's cheshbon is pranios needs to come, then it's more likely to come on Bein HaMetzarim or on a Tisha B'Av than on other days. And if a Kadosh Baruch Hu decides that pranios needs to come, it's more likely to come in Shechem than another day. So when we say, for example, if a person has a Din Torah, he should not do it in Av because it's a day of pranios. It doesn't mean that if the court case comes out in Av that he's going to lose. Nor does it mean that if it's not in Av, then he's going to win. The same thing we say in Adar is a good time. That's a mezumen for Yeshua. So it means if he has a court case in Adar, he's going to win. Not necessarily. However, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu has some kind of cheshbon against him, then it's more likely to be fulfilled in Av than in Adar, or in any other days for that matter. So it is not that the time or the place causes the pranios. It means that if there is reason for pranios, then it may be that that time is mesugal for that to take effect. Whereas if it wouldn't be that time, it might be delayed. Because Rebbe might find a different etza. But the time does not create the problem, and the place does not create the problem. It's only a means, a way of, so to speak, carrying it out. In general, I mentioned the idea of segulos. I think there's a tendency in recent years to be a little bit overdoing the whole segula angle. That becomes a substitute for real Yiddishkeit. You know, segulas are segulas, but they don't make things happen. You know, it's chait and it's tshuva and ma'isim tovim. When it says, Chazal say, Yisurim ba'al adam, if a person has difficulties, yifashre shemasav, he should examine his deeds. It doesn't say, yechapes achar segulas. It doesn't even say he should check his mezuzahs. So I'm not saying you shouldn't check your mezuzahs. But that's not the whole story, and it's not even the main part of the story. So a person needs to understand that the world is run, and throughout Navi we see this time and time again. The world is run through our adherence to Torah, to mitzvahs and chatoim. And of course, within that, Kadosh Baruch Hu finds his ways of dealing with things. The reason why the Malchus was split was not because Rechavim went to Shechem. The reason why the Malchus was split was because of the chatoim of Shlomo HaMelech and based off it, and they didn't deserve to keep the kingdom. But if the Malchus was going to be split, it's not surprising that it took place in Shechem. That is the concept of a makom that's mesugal for pranios.
What about with Yericho? How does that fit in? That things would happen if you...
No, that's because you're violating the curse. That's something else. That itself is wrong. Building Yericho is an aver, and the punishment is that your children die. By the way, it's an astounding event also. What he's referring to was that there was a klala placed on whoever would rebuild Yericho, that when he lays the foundation, his oldest son will die, and when he finishes the gates, his youngest son will die. And we find later in Navi, a person did that, and that's what happened. His oldest son died when he laid the foundations, and his youngest son died when he finished the project. That means the children were dying all along. You would think he would stop. He knew about the klala. So let's say he started building the city because he convinced himself it doesn't apply or he doesn't care and this. But you know, you see what's happening. Why did you stop? But people can be unbelievably stubborn. You get a decision, an idea in your mind, and that's it, nothing stops me. Another example is, this was a Russia, but you have this with a person who's a relative tzaddikus. The story of Penina and Chana. It says that Chana, we know for a long time, had no children, and Penina used to tease her. And the Gemara says that she was mechaven l'shem shemayim. Penina did this because she wanted Chana to daven better and have children. So although it was wrong, because you're still not supposed to cause pain to a person, even if it's Lashem Shemayim, but Penina was not, you know, a Russia. She was doing what she thought was right. So it said, the pasuk says, "Hine akara yalda shiva v'rabas banim umlala." Akara is a barren woman, gave birth to seven, and rabas banim, one who had many children, umlala, was desolate. So this was a reference to the fact that Penina had 10 children, Chana had none, but eventually Chana gave birth to children. We find in the Divrei Hayamim, Chana had 5 children. But it says, Akar Yalda Shiva, how is that? It says, every time that Chana had a child, 2 of Penina's children died. So when the fourth child of Chana was born, 8 of Penina's 10 children died. She had 2 left. Chana became pregnant again. So Penina came to Chana and begged her to daven for her that the children shouldn't die. So she did, and those last 2 children did not die. So they're credited to Chana's account. She had 5 of her own children and 2 of Penina's children. That comes out to 7. But the question that bothered me is, why did she wait so long? It took 4 children. The first time, okay, you know, first time, I understand. Coincidence, it happened to die when she was born. Second time. Right? The Gemara says when it comes to Pikuach Nefesh, 2 is already a chazaka. So wait till the 3rd. It took 4 times. Because Penina was so convinced that what she did was right, like she couldn't make the connection. It wasn't until after 4 times that she finally made that connection, and maybe she wasn't so right, and maybe she needed to ask Chana for forgiveness. But it was, people like decide to do things can become so fixed in their ways and so stubborn that the evidence in front of their eyes doesn't change them. But that was a little tangent. Yes.
Where is Shechem today?
It's in Shechem. We have the place. Yes, Nablus, the Arab name. It's in what people call the West Bank, Yehuda Vishavrad, but it's mostly an Arab city now. And it's ironic. Many people have pointed this out. There are 3 cities in Eretz Yisrael that Tanakh actually records that Jewish people buying them. That's Shechem, parts of Shechem anyway, Hebron and Yerushalayim, and those are the ones that are the most challenged. The most difficulty, they challenge the whole Eretz Yisrael, but Shechem, Yerushalayim, and Hebron are like tops on the list. But Shechem is north of Yerushalayim, in the valleys of the hills, whatever it is, of Yehuda.
And if that's the concept, then what's the story with Gaza Strip? Was that part of the...
No, not really.
Oh.
Gaza was never really part of Eretz Yisrael.
Was it Eretz?
So... Okay, let's proceed. Well, there might be a connection, some people suggest, there might be a connection between these 3 peronios that were listed. The connection between the Mechir of Yosef and the splitting of the kingdom is somewhat easy. Mechir of Yosef represents the pirah, the separation between Yehuda and Yosef. And this too represents this is the other side. This is Yosef separating from Yehuda. So that connection is pretty easy, but the incident with Dina does not seem to be as related. But that suggestion could be made that it's not so much the event of Dina, but the aftermath. That Shimon and Levi wiped out the city of Shechem without consulting with Yaakov. Yaakov criticized them for it, but that was a period of separation of Shimon and Levi from Yaakov Avinu. Shimon and Levi were the ringleaders in selling or killing Yosef. They were the ones who actually wanted to kill Yosef. Then Yehuda, commuted the sentence to selling him into slavery. So it was really Shimon and Levi who led the charge, and Shimon and Levi distanced themselves from Yaakov Avinu in the incident of Dina, and that's perhaps why they remained distant and were able to instigate this, what ended up being the sale of Yosef. All right. Now, an interesting point, I've seen also that people raise that we talk about a place or a time that's Mukhan L'Peronios. You know, again, it's hard to know ultimately the reasons for such things and how these things work. But there was a certain benefit, one might even say, from having that. The fact that there are certain linkages in history helps reveal the Yad Hashem. And the fact that such a disproportionate amount of Peronios happened in a place like Shechem, which was Mukhan L'Peronios, or a disproportionate amount of Tzoros happened on Yom Kippur, on Tisha B'Av, that demonstrates more the Yad Hashem in history. That the Churban Bayis Rishon and the Churban Bayis Sheni both took place on Tisha B'Av. You know, other events in history took place on or near Tisha B'Av. The beginning of World War I, which really from a historical perspective could be looked as a continuous event that led to the Holocaust, because the seeds of the Holocaust were already planted in World War I. It took place on Tisha B'Av. So this quote-unquote coincidence, or better said, this linkage shows us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is behind history. And that's a tzad nechama. You know, people have to know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is watching, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is involved. As the mashal that Chazal bring on the pasuk, Shiftecha Mishantecha Hema Yenachamuni. So the pasuk refers, it says, your stick and your staff, they comfort me. How does the stick comfort you? So the Chazal say, Mashal Ma'adar V'Dome, you have a sheep that's wandered away from the flock. Sheep are very herd oriented. When they are separated from the flock, they get nervous, they panic. So this sheep is separated from the flock. He doesn't know where the other sheep are. And he's in a state of panic. And all of a sudden, the shepherd's out there looking for this missing sheep. And he finds it. And he gives the sheep a whack with the stick to send it in the right direction. So you feel the pain of the stick. But the sheep is really happy he's been found. The shepherd has just whacked him. He knows he's going to go back and return to the flock. So the worst fear, the worst sorrow for Kali Yisrael is the feeling that Kadosh Baruch Hu has abandoned us. So So a person feels he's abandoned by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If you could see how the hand of Hashem is working, then at least you know you're not abandoned. And that itself is a nechama. So when these charts happen, a person can feel abandoned. They happen on Tisha B'Av. Wait a minute. Why Tisha B'Av? And then you see, oh, this is all part of the history. It's all part of the... Okay, obviously we don't want the tzaris, but if they have to come, they come in such a way, it reveals to a certain extent the Yad Hashem, and that itself could be a tzad nechama. Okay, let's take a look at Pasuk Beis. Vayihi kishmoa Yerubbaal ben Nevat. When Yerubbaal ben heard the hu'aldenu ben Mitzrayim, and he was still in Egypt, asher barach, where he escaped mipnei Shlomo HaMelech, from before Shlomo the king, vayeshev Yerubbaal Mitzrayim, and Yerubbaal lived in Mitzrayim. This is a very confusing pasuk. Pasuk says, when he heard, so you're expecting that he's going to do something. Vayhi kishma, it came to pass when Yerubbaal heard that, whatever it is that he heard, that's a different problem, we'll get to it in a moment, he's going to do something. So what does the pasuk say? He heard while he was still in Mitzrayim, and he lived in Mitzrayim. So what did he do? Secondly, what did he hear? Vayhi kishma Yerubbaal. So the Mefarshim explain as follows. What he heard was not simply the death of Shlomo HaMelech, which took place in the last parak, because if that's what he heard, then this pasuk would have been there or before the first pasuk. But he heard about the gathering in Shechem. So Yerubbaal was nobody's fool. Yerubbaal understood that if there's a gathering in Shechem, that things are not necessarily so good for Rechavam. If, as we said before, if things are going smoothly, it would have been in Yerushalayim. And maybe even knew exactly what the complaints of Kali Yisrael were. And he knew that Achia Shiloni had prophesied that he would take over the kingdom. So one would think that a person in that position would say, this is my opportunity. Here everyone's coming to Shechem, they're upset with Rechavam. Here's my chance. I could go, I could be a rabble-rouser, I could rally the troops around me, Before you know it, I'll be king, and I know I'm going to be successful because, after all, I have a nevuah from Achi Ashiloni. So what did Yeravam do? Nothing. Vayeshev Yeravam b'Mitzrayim. He was in Mitzrayim, and he's still in Mitzrayim. Why? So this is a testament to the great Midos Tovos and stature of Yeravam. Now we are going to discover that Yeravam becomes a very big Russia. But it's not because he was a nobody. He was, as we mentioned before, he was on an equal level to Achi Ashiloni in Torah, ahead of everybody else. Everyone else was like grass compared to him and Achia. He was a shalom in many ways. He did have a weakness, the need for kavod. It was already acted upon when he gave tochacha to Shlomo HaMelech, which may have been correct, but the manner in which he did it was incorrect. And he exhibited certain rebellion against Shlomo. He probably felt justified in what he did because Shlomo was sinning. And he felt that he was standing up for the Kavod Shemayim. But he wasn't doing it in the proper way. So the seeds of his downfall were there. But even at this moment, he was still a tzaddik. And he behaved in the proper fashion. As Chazal tells us, Ein docha kines hashah. You don't push the hour. Even if you're destined for greatness, you don't run after it. That's not the humble way to behave, not the proper way to behave. The Gemara tells a story that I don't remember who it was. It was Rav Huna. I don't remember who it was that passed away. It was the Rosh Yeshiva. And there was a discussion in the yeshiva who should be the next Rosh Yeshiva, Rabba or Rav Yosef. And they sent, Rav Yosef had heard one of these, whatever they are, soothsayers, predictors, saying that he was going to rule, so to speak. He was going to be the Rosh Yeshiva. But they sent the Shaila to Eretz Yisrael, to the Gedolim in Eretz Yisrael. And they basically paskin that Rav Yosef should be the Rosh Yeshiva. Rav Yosef declined the position. So they ended up giving it to Rabba anyway. And Rabba was Rosh Yeshiva for, I think it was 38 years. And then when Rabba passed away, Rav Yosef became the Rosh Yeshiva, and he was Rosh Yeshiva for 2 years. Then he passed away. So the Gemara says, Ein docha kines hashah, don't push the hour. Don't jump for greatness. He said, had Rav Yosef taken the position right away, he would have lived only for 2 years, and then he would have died. It was destined he should be Rosh Yeshiva for 2 years. He would have taken the position right away. He would have had his 2 years, and then he would die. This way, he deferred to Rabba, so he had his 2 years 38 years later. So he lived an extra 38 years. So, ein dalkinis hashah. You don't push. Even though you know you're supposed to be there. That's an inyan of anava. That's an inyan of humility. A similar thing happened in Eretz Yisrael after Rebbe passed away. So the idea is that the proper midos, the proper combination of humility is not to push for your position. So even though Yeravim had a golden opportunity falling into his lap, he didn't go until they called him. When they called him, then he felt he had to respond. But before that, despite the fact that he knew what was going on, he had heard these reports, and he knew in a certain sense, he must have known that this was really an opportunity for him. And it could be he even knew that it was going to happen. He realized, here's the Nebuah of Achi Ashiloni unfolding before my very eyes. It does, you know, he could easily have figured that out. But what does that have to do with me? It's not my job to run. If a Kadosh Baruch Hu wants me to be king, I'll be king. And don't show, you don't push yourself forward. The Kli Yakar adds a little twist to this. He suggests that the phrase, Vayeshev, let's get it right, Vayeshev Yeravam Mitzrayim, should be interpreted similarly to the phrase we find in the Chumash. It says, V'yosef hayav Mitzrayim. An extra phrase, V'yosef hayav Mitzrayim, Chazal Darshan, Hu Yosef b'beis Yaakov, Hu Yosef b'Mitzrayim. The same Yosef that was in the Beis Yaakov was the same Yosef in Mitzrayim. He remained with his greatness. He remained with his Torah. Was not influenced by his plight and his situation in Mitzrayim. Which, even though, as Rashi there points out, he was taken away from his father's home at the age of 17, and he was a slave, and now he's a king. and a king could do whatever he wants, still he remained loyal to Torah. So in a similar way, so by Yeshev, Yerubim Mitzrayim, it's the same Yerubim. Just as we said before, when Yerubim was in Eretz Yisrael, that he was, let's see the expression. V'ish Yerubim Gibor Chayil, he was a Gibor Chayil, and Shnehem Levadam Basada, that the two of them were alone in the field, that he and Achia were in the same level. He remained at that level while he was still in Mitzrayim. The downfall came after he became king, and it didn't take very long. It was a very rapid downfall because the seeds of the disaster were there, and he didn't control it, and then it could explode. Rabbi Saul Salanter talks about the concept in Musar that sometimes you could have a person that appears to be very great and in a certain sense is very great and then suddenly falls off the cliff. In fact, I saw that there was in one of the editions of Rabbi Saul, there's a parish with footnotes. He brings a story from the Yeshiva of Nevardak, that there was a Talmud in the Yeshiva Nevardak who was known in the Yeshiva as being the biggest masmid in the Yeshiva, which obviously was an accomplishment. There was a big Yeshiva and there were a lot of masmidim, and he was kula shakua, totally involved in learning Torah. His father passed away and he went home from the Yeshiva to sort of take over the business. Some of his chaverim, it wasn't so easy to travel in those days, some of his chaverim who hadn't seen him since he went home came to visit him. I think, I don't remember if the story was 1 month later or 2 months later. They found him completely involved in the business and wasn't learning at all the entire day. What happened? Here this guy was such a super masmid, and within a month he's not even opening up a sefer. You could see how a person little by little gets caught up in his business and abandons his learning, but in 1 month, from the I said this. This is an illustration of what Rabbi Saul's concept. This is a person who had a weakness for money and for trying to acquire money. But he wasn't in a position to act on that weakness. He was sitting in an environment, there was no money to be had, right? And what are you going to do? So there's no opportunities to get involved. And in that environment, he was talking a huge masman. But when he was faced with his weakness, he didn't overcome it, he didn't work on it, he didn't resist it, so then it didn't take very long before it totally obliterated his asmada. So there was a weakness in Yerubim and he failed to control that weakness. Kozman, before he became king, it didn't manifest itself that much, only in those incidents where he already had a svar why he did what he did. But then when he came into the situation where whatever it is, his need for kavod or whatever you touch up, the weakness of Yerubim, since he was unchecked, he didn't fight it. When the proper Nisayon came up, then everything fell apart. And there is a famous story, which probably isn't true. I found it very disappointing when I was told that. I heard the story many, many years ago. So I once heard Rabbi Lev speak, and he said the story is probably not true. The research doesn't indicate any source for it, and he said the story, besides, has been said about 3 or 4 different people. So that also adds suspicion to it. But I heard it about the Rabbi. Whether the story is true or not is irrelevant, because it's a great story anyway. It illustrates the point. Maybe the Rabbi gave it as a mushel, I don't know. But the story goes that the courtiers of the caliph, the king, where the Rambam lived, had told the king that they were able to civilize cats. They could train cats to behave in a civilized, sophisticated manner. And this became this whole project. He was training these cats, and it came the big day. The cats are going to serve a royal banquet, and they're going to follow all the rules of protocol of the royal household. And he dressed up the cats in an outfit, whatever they're supposed to, and they're standing on their two hind legs, and they're carrying in the trays, and they're serving right side, left side, whatever is the forks. I don't know what all the protocol is. To this day, I never know which fork or spoon to use. I never do. We have the spoon on the side and the spoon in the front. Like, which one are you supposed to use first? I don't know. But, so they're following all the rules, and everyone is oohing and aahing, is tremendously impressed, except the Rambam, who is sitting there totally unimpressed with a little box on the table. So the king says to Rambam, aren't you impressed? They've civilized the cats. They haven't civilized the cat. They've trained the cat to act in a civilized fashion. Let's see when the second course is served if they're really civilized. So the cats come out to serve the second course. Rambam opens the box. By now I'm sure you all figure out what's in the box. A couple of mice. The mice scoot across the table. The cats scoot across the table chasing the mice. But what's the point? The point is that you haven't changed the nature of a cat. A cat cannot learn Musar. You haven't changed the nature of the cat. So you could civilize him externally and get him to do all kinds of things. But when the Nisayon arises, that hits their weak spot, they have no ability to control it. So if a person doesn't work on himself and doesn't learn Torah in the right way, he learned Torah, but he didn't focus on his own shortcomings, he didn't learn Musar, so although he currently was a tzaddik in all ways, and his learning was terrific, and his behavior was terrific, and even had midos tovos. It wasn't just a superficial, external, you know, pretend behavior. He had midos tovos, and he wasn't dovnas hashon. He heard this opportunity, didn't run after it. But since the underlying problem was never fixed, when he was placed in the set of circumstances that challenged that weakness, then it led to a terrible and disastrous downfall. And he was that cat running across the table. He had lost all his greatness, or at least to a significant extent. So that is the... But at this point in time, Yerubim was still a, what one would consider a tzaddik. He looked at him, Basher Husham, he would still be ruled and judged as a tzaddik, was still worthy to be king, which is... But in the matter, I don't know whether it was weeks or months, we will find the great disaster that occurred after Yerubim became the king. Okay, I guess we'll stop here. So I want to wish everybody a very restful, productive summer. I know many of us are not resting, but hopefully you get some break, some vacation.